If you were unable to attend this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, we have good news for you. We produced an audio DVD of the conference. The recording contains all of the speakers' presentations, my Divine Service sermon, and the hymn sing. We'll send you the audio DVD for a donation of $300 to Issues Etc. before Labor Day. Click the audio DVD logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or you can also order by check. Make your $300 check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Order your audio DVD of the 2015 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkett. We talk a lot about the Lutheran doctrine of vocation. It's really the scriptural doctrine of vocation here on the program. And student is one that's a little more difficult to sort out, because if you think of vocation merely in terms of employment or a job, you're going to get this one wrong. We need a distinctly Lutheran view of vocation to talk about the vocation of student. Joining us to do so on this Wednesday afternoon, July the 30th, Dr. Corey Moss. He's assistant professor of history at Hillsdale College, and he's author of a chapter in the book The Idea and Practice of a Christian University, titled The Vocation of a Student. Dr. Moss, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be back with you. Thank you.
Lots of different confessions of faith have a doctrine of vocation, Catholic, Protestant. Luther's probably, it's one of the things he's more famous for, although he, as you know, would have simply considered it Scripture's teaching on the Christian's calling. But what do we need to understand about a distinctively Lutheran doctrine of vocation in order to understand the vocation of students?
Yeah, good question. The short answer is simply, if we want to talk about the vocation of a student, it becomes incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to do so using one of the other popular definitions and understandings of vocation. So, for example, the traditional, we might say medieval, Catholic understanding of vocation is largely reserved to the clergy or the monastic orders. And even at religious colleges, Lutheran colleges, Catholic colleges, evangelical colleges, we don't tend to think of students as clergy doing the sorts of things that clergy do. The more contemporary, we might call secular understanding of vocation, is that which simply reduces vocation to, you know, paid employment, occupation. But once again, students, for the most part, are not being paid to attend college or university, and so it's not an occupation in that sense. So, you know, the two sort of traditional ways of understanding vocation just don't really work for talking about students as students having a vocation. And so, almost by default, we would have to fall back on a Lutheran understanding.
So what is that understanding? Flesh it out for us so we can see a student's role here, as we would say, in service of their neighbor in faith toward God.
Well, it works like this. So, reacting against that narrow medieval understanding, that holy spiritual understanding of vocation, Luther insisted that all legitimate stations, callings, including occupations, are just that, vocations, stations into which we are called by God. So that includes things like motherhood, fatherhood, childhood. Things that we're not getting paid to do, but stations and relationships that we find ourselves called into by God. And aside from the nature and scope of vocation, the Lutheran understanding or the Lutheran doctrine of vocation has a very different understanding of the end or the goal or the object of vocation. So again, that medieval understanding, we might consider the end or object to be God himself. What the priest does is offer sacrifices to God. What the monk does is, offer prayers to God and speak even of his manual labor as being a form of prayer. In the sort of modern secular understanding of vocation, the object or end, although it's not explicitly stated as such, I think we could recognize as simply being the self. I take paid employment so that I can receive a salary, and I can buy things that I want. But in the Lutheran understanding, the object of one's vocation is neither God nor the self, but one's neighbor. And that does set the Lutheran understanding of vocation apart from alternatives, but as listeners might have already guessed, it does raise certain problems for understanding how we might talk about a student having a vocation. You know, in what sense are students serving other people?
Well, I guess let's kind of take that apart a little bit. I mean, the question is simple. Who are the students' neighbors? But then the answers get complicated because it kind of some of these relationships seem a little inverted to us. Let's start with the student himself.
Sure.
Often people will view going to the university, the college, not only as pursuing a career, but there's also another facet to it, and that's kind of self-edification. I'm going to learn something which I may never use, probably will never use, but I'm better off for having learned it. Is there a room in a Lutheran doctrine of vocation for self-edification in education?
Well, there certainly is. We'd want to, you know, unpack it and nuance it. And you know, Luther and Melanchthon, from day one, do sometimes talk about this. You know, that the good of a liberal education is a good in and of itself. Luther, as is his wont, speaking hyperbolically at one point, says, a liberal education would be a good, you know, even if there were no souls, you know, even if it benefited to no eternal end, and even if it had no practical good in this life, if it didn't contribute to, you know, better service in the church, better service in society. It's just a good thing because, you know, God made us intelligent creatures, and therefore we are to exercise our intellectual capacities, and that's one of the things that we do in a university.
All right. The student's relationship to the instructor or the professor in the case of the university, is there's obviously service being rendered from the professor to the student. What about from the student to the professor?
Right, and this is a major point, and it's perhaps one of the more difficult hurdles that a contemporary student will have to get over if he's to think of himself as exercising a vocation in the classroom, because we do have this unhealthy assumption that we enter the classroom as students and we're merely passive receptacles. And it's the professor's vocation, you know, to pour knowledge into us, to tell us things, and then maybe we often raise our hand and ask, is this going to be on the test? But the student has a number of obligations to the professor, which, if those are not fulfilled, then the professor can't effectively fulfill his own obligations, his own vocation. So, for example, it's going all the way back to classical antiquity. You know, one of the model forms of education is the dialogue, where, you know, Socrates, for example, is not standing at a podium, you know, lecturing students, but he's asking questions and trying to engage them to see what they know, what they can contribute, what they might correct in false impressions or assumptions. And that's one of the things that we might call an obligation inhering in the vocation of a student, to enter the classroom prepared to participate, not only listening, but asking questions, even pushing back against what is heard to test it. And for the most part, I would say professors find this eminently stimulating. It makes their job easier if students are engaged and engaging in a dialogue.
I think we've observed before, many times when we've talked about vocation, that vocations often come in pairs: husband, wife, parents, child,
right,
employer, employee, or master, slave, depending on how you want to read the language there. We would talk here about teacher, student, but it's a mutual service.
That's right, and this is a sort of observation that is made, you know, throughout history. Already in classical antiquity, Plutarch uses the analogy of playing catch. You know, that only works if both people are throwing and catching and moving about to allow a thrown ball to be caught by the other. more recently, Mortimer Adler, a great educational theorist and reformer of the 20th century, makes the analogy to the classical Hippocratic understanding of medicine. An operation, for example, is a remedy of last resort, because there the physician is simply, you know, operating by himself on the body. Ideally, medicine is a cooperative art where the patient and the doctor cooperate in healing. And this is, it's a recurring theme, and it just sometimes gets lost in our, for whatever reason, contemporary notion that the student files into the classroom, slumps into his seat. If he's a really good student, turns off his cell phone and stows it away, and then just stares blankly while the professor speaks. That's never how it's been meant to take place.
Okay. Parents, do they play any role here? If we're talking about the classical scenario of the student being still in some sense, even though they're away at school, in some sense resident under their parents' roof or something like that.
Right.
Do parents play a role in the vocation of the student?
They do. And I suppose here it's maybe worth making some fine distinctions. On the one hand, we're simply always going to say, in a Lutheran understanding, that children have a vocation with respect to their parents, have obligations and duties towards their parents, simply by the fact that they are the children of their parents. But if we say, well, as students, not simply as children of their parents, but as students per se, do they have obligations to their parents? And I think the answer still has to be yes. On a very simple level, the vast majority of students are at college or university, you know, on their parents' dime, as it were. If the parents are not paying for their education, they are almost certainly co-signing loans, making that education possible. And so, in a kind of crass way of putting it, the parents have paid for the product, and so the student has an obligation to, you know, appropriate, to take hold of, take possession of that product that has been paid for. I hate to use that sort of crassly commercial language, but by way of illustration, perhaps it works.
Now, are we also thinking here about future neighbors? Often, education is undertaken with a long-term, very long-term goal in mind.
No, that's right. And again, that's the sort of distinction that we want to make. Even if we are talking about vocational training in the modern way that we tend to think about vocation, you're training for a particular occupation, to be a doctor, to be a lawyer, in a very real sense, you are preparing yourself for a vocation that you don't yet have. You know, you're a 19-year-old, 20-year-old undergraduate. You're not a doctor. You're not a lawyer. But you're hoping to be, and you're preparing to be. And so you can think of yourself as, even at this point, having very real duties and obligations towards people that you have not even met yet, people that will be in your office or in your practice. You are, even now, doing them a disservice, not fulfilling your duty to them, if you are not learning all that is made available to you.
Dr. Corey Moss is our guest. We're talking about the vocation of a student. He's assistant professor of history at Hillsdale College. We'll be right back.
You might wonder, is it possible for my child with special needs to receive a rich classical Christian education? Issues Etc. guest Cheryl Swope answers yes. With the Simply Classical curriculum created by Cheryl and published by Memoria Press, there's no reason to withhold a beautiful education from any struggling student. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR. classicalspecialneeds.com.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Lutheran Talk.
In Lutheranism, I come as a guilty sinner in need of hearing the forgiving words of Christ every single time I gather. Every single time.
Lutheran music.
It's teaching, it's pure.
the new Lutheran Public Radio app. Download for iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, and Kindle at issuesztc.org. We're talking about the vocation of student. Dr. Corey Moss is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. You might feel like time has passed you by and the opportunity to take full advantage of that vocation of student has also passed you by. You've got family, you got kids, and you think you're too busy or don't have the time for a degree or some kind of certification. Concordia University, Wisconsin has an online system that is absolutely unbelievable. They value lifelong Lutheran learning. They have 50 online educational options ranging from a certificate to a doctorate degree. Programs are available 100% online, but you can also have a face-to-face option if you like at various centers across the Midwest, including one in St. Louis. Click the Concordia University Wisconsin online logo at our website, issuesztc.org, and enter the program code ISSUES. They'll let you waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin, online. Dr. Moss, let's talk about one of the nuts and bolts of the studently vocation, which is homework or schoolwork. It's not usually viewed as joyful service to the neighbor. Usually drudgery, if you assign a class a 25-page paper, they're all going to groan, and half of them will ask you when it's due and if they can get an extension. And you know how they're doing the math, Dr. Moss.
That's right. That's right. I mean, on the one hand, we certainly do want to put this in the category of, you know, the relationship with the professor, duties one owes to the professor. And if students are not aware of this, let me just make it clear to students or future students. As a professor, I read a lot of papers, term papers, essays on exams, and it makes my job so much easier if these essays have been given more than, you know, 2 minutes thought or 2 hours thought before they were hastily written up and turned in. It makes my job easier if the student does his or her job on the front end. But perhaps less obvious, we might talk about the relationship between students. Because we live in a late modern, very individualistic culture, and especially in the context of colleges and universities, a very competitive culture, students can sometimes shy away from cooperative learning. And I think in a very real sense, we should understand that students do have obligations to one another as students. And again, this is a sort of thing that's been understood for a long time. We could look even at the very nature of the word college from collegium and from our notions of collegiality. It's a collective and cooperative endeavor. There's a reason that we put students together in classrooms and in dormitories and on university campuses, rather than everybody simply hiring individual tutors.
And the fellow students, I guess that kind of raises the question of the student's vocation with respect to the fellow student.
Right. There's, all of us have different gifts. And part of the reason that we come together in a college or university environment is so that, iron can sharpen iron, not simply in a conversation between professor and student, but in conversations between students. And this is one of the things that I try to impress on my students, especially if they're, first-year freshmen. They're, kind of shy, reluctant to engage. When I throw out a question and ask for feedback and dialogue and discussion, it's partly for my benefit. I want to know what you think, and I want you to perhaps even tell me things that I've not fully considered before. But it's also for the sake of your fellow students. Show them how this is done. Perhaps articulate the sort of thing that they're thinking, but they don't quite know how to articulate. You're all in this together. This isn't really a competition for a grade. It's not a zero-sum game.
Although that is, especially if they're doing the classical grading scheme of on a curve, sometimes it is viewed as a competition, isn't it?
It is, and especially if they're thinking long distance in terms of competition for employment. You know, you want to graduate at the top of your class because, you know, there are only so many jobs out there and even fewer good-paying jobs. So, you know, we can be tempted to think, this is a zero-sum game. And if I get a better grade by not cooperating with my fellow students, that's good for me and too bad for them. Which is when it becomes important to recall that being a student is not simply for the good of oneself. But if we're thinking about being a student in terms of having a vocation, we are meant to be serving others at the same time.
We've talked here, Dr. Moss, about student in kind of the very kind of colloquial term, that is a classroom, an instructor, an institution of education surrounding all of that. The work and all those things, and I think that applies most broadly. What about the vocation of the lifelong student, the person who will continue to learn, perhaps not even in the classroom, or perhaps in a classroom or two throughout their life? How would you think? Right. How would you have us think about that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And you know, in this particular essay in the book that we're discussing, I didn't get a chance to talk about this, and I wish I had. Have the space and then the time to cover it. But we might also think about us, ourselves being lifelong students, you know, sitting at the feet of, you know, the authors of the great works that we're reading, even in our own leisure time, as having obligations, for example, to those authors. You know, if I'm reading Moby Dick on a beach for my own edification, or if I'm reading a bit of nonfiction because I, for some reason, wanted to know about this or that period of history, this or that scientific theory, I have a duty to these authors to read them charitably, to do my best to understand what they're saying and why they're saying it, and not to read them contentiously, not to read them simply looking for you know, arrows in my quiver to shoot down colleagues who happen to disagree with me about this, that, or the other thing.
Then I think the thing that students, especially in college and university, might find most difficult a struggle in their vocation as students is the fact that sometimes the university and sometimes the classroom is a place that is at least intellectually and philosophically hostile to Christianity. I'd like your thoughts on that.
Well, this is very much the case, and not only sometimes philosophically hostile to Christianity, but I mean, unfortunately, sometimes philosophically hostile to real education. And so, in some sense, we might talk about the vocation of a student beginning, you know, even before they enter the classroom. The student has an obligation to seek out the kinds of professors who will best help them to learn, and who will not make it their, you know, object to either tear down a student's faith or to coddle a student intellectually, but one who can approach the big questions, including the big questions of theology, fairly and seriously. And you know, happily, I think that those professors can be found even in the most unlikely places. You know, chances are you're not going to find that professor for every course that you take in college, but they can be found and they should be sought out.
Does the Christian student sitting in that classroom or studying with other students in college or university, where they know that the subject matter or the professor or maybe even the whole rest of the class is at odds with them on an issue, that they simply can't buy into the truth of postmodernism or whatever it may be, is part of their studently vocation to be the naysayer? In that case, gently, politely, but to be the one who raises his hand and perhaps objects.
Well, I think so, and I think absolutely so. You know, one of the duties that has always been discussed in the context of education is the duty to pursue truth. You know, this is the whole point of education, And so if one is hearing something that one knows or thinks or strongly believes to be untrue, then certainly one has an obligation to challenge that. And yes, certainly to do so gently and not to take over the entire discussion for the entire semester. But certainly, one has a duty to the truth. One has a duty to the professor or fellow student who may be dismissing or ignoring or not seeing the truth. Again, part of that cooperative venture that is education.
The goal of all of this for many people, and you deal with this at some length in your essay, the goal is usually, I want to get a job that pays well. And it's kind of a classical American dream capitalist goal in education.
Right.
How can that actually, while it's impossible to ignore that aspect of it, everybody wants a job, but there's nothing wrong with that. It's impossible to ignore it. How can that purely kind of capitalist motivation for getting my education actually hinder a Christian vocation of student?
Well, it can do so in a whole host of ways. I mean, one of the most immediate ways is if you enter college as a freshman, knowing, or again, just sort of firmly believing, I'm going to be X, Y, or Z when I graduate. There's this tendency then to not take too terribly seriously, not work too terribly hard at classes that might be quote unquote irrelevant to that. So if I'm convinced that I'm going to be a veterinarian, what point is this class that I'm taking in medieval literature? The animals don't care. I'm not really spending much time talking to their owners in a veterinarian clinic. And so that kind of blinkered, monetary, goal-oriented perspective can prevent one from getting a full education and knowing the truth about certain things.
Finally, all of this is obviously in the context of the kind of the flip side of vocation, which is faith toward God. You even quote, I believe, Luther saying, faith serves God. By faith, God is served. By works, the neighbor is served. How should we rightly understand the essential origin of Christian vocation, whatever it may be, in this case, student, in faith toward God?
Yeah, no, this is absolutely crucial, and it's an implication of that central law-gospel distinction that Luther recovers and champions, and that is still distinctive of confessional Lutheranism. Properly understanding vocation in this way allows us, or at least encourages us, not to slip into a kind of works righteousness. And so, in our contemporary context, when people hear the word vocation, they think of occupation and, monetary remuneration. And I think rightly, many Christians find that reductive conception not helpful, perhaps even impious. And so we've seen this, booming literature on what's variously called, the faith and work concept. And how can I serve God in my work? I'm not just doing this to get a paycheck. I'm doing this in some sense to serve God. And while that's understandable, and it certainly is pious, that quotation from the Large Catechism that you mentioned nicely encapsulates the distinctively Lutheran way of thinking about this. God does not need our service. God is not going to, become hungry if we're not doing something, or suffer if we're not doing something in a kind of literalistic way. Our neighbor needs our good works. Our relationship with God is predicated on our trust in Him, on our faith, not on what we're doing for Him. And so, really understanding this notion of vocation helps us keep clear that whatever it is we're doing is for the benefit of our neighbor. And although it is God-pleasing and God-honoring and God-glorifying, we are not doing it primarily for the sake of God, and that's okay.
Dr. Corey Moss is assistant professor of history at Hillsdale College. He's author of a chapter in the book, The Idea and Practice of a Christian University. The chapter is titled, The Vocation of a Student. Dr. Moss, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you for having me.
Folks, you'll find a link to the book, The Idea and Practice of a Christian University, under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-34. Dr. Corey Moss is going to join us again after the break. Tomorrow, the church is going to observe the person and work of 16th century Lutheran martyr Robert Barnes, and we'll get a biography of Robert Barnes from Dr. Moss. You can listen at Lutheran Talk Radio 24/7, issuesetc.org, or on the new Lutheran Public Radio mobile app. That's right after this at issuesetc.org or on the app. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., Terry Mattingly will join us for our weekly feature on media coverage of religion. On Friday, we'll discuss the second article of the Apostles' Creed, Son of God, with Pastor Paul McCann of Concordia Publishing House. And we'll conclude our series on the Book of Ephesians with Dr. Thomas Winger. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.